The log cabin Republicans are very explicit about their strategy, which is to make sure that gay rights becomes a bipartisan issue, and that both of the parties have to compete for the gay vote instead of the Democrats being able to essentially take it for granted, which for the most part they have been in past elections.
In the GLBT community, there are many of us who are progressive, and we say to our people, we need to see ourselves as part of a broader social justice movement.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Lucia Chappelle. Eurocourt finds British sex law gross and indecent.
Malaysian court stalls on Anwar sodomy verdict.
And the inside and the outskirts of Republican politics.
All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Chase Schulte.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 5th, 2000. The European Court of Human Rights ruled unanimously this week that Britain's gay-only gross indecency law violates European privacy rights. The 1885 law that jailed Oscar Wilde criminalizes sex between men when any third party is present, even by choice, although often the third party is the arresting police officer. Gross indecency was charged in some 350 cases last year. In the case before the court, police had obtained a home video showing a gay man referred to as ADT at a sex party with several men in his home. In 1996, he was given a conditional 2-year suspended sentence for what the 7 European judges agreed were activities that were purely and genuinely private. Having found that the law violated the European Convention on Human Rights' guarantee of respect for a private family life, the court did not go on to consider ADT's claim that the gay-only law represents gender discrimination. The British government is reviewing the decision, but had already marked the gross indecency law for repeal as part of a proposed major sex crime law reform published last week. The panel that developed the reform proposals wrote that the review can find no justification for retaining an offense that deals solely with same-sex behavior between consenting adults in private. The National Gay and Lesbian Advocacy Group Stonewall's executive director, Angela Mason, said, "I believe the government will now have to issue a directive to police officers telling them not to continue prosecutions under this offense."
In one of the world's most famous sodomy cases, the 14-month-long trial of Malaysia's former Deputy Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim, there was an unexpected delay this week. High Court Justice Arafin Jaka had been due to hand down his verdict, but instead advised attorneys there would be a delay without setting a new date or giving any explanation. Anwar's political supporters had planned a demonstration outside the courthouse, and 300 to 500 of them showed up anyway, despite police warning they would break up the crowd. Although there was pushing and shoving by police in riot gear, no one was injured, but 4 opposition political leaders were arrested. In one of many side issues to the main trial, Anwar this week abandoned his attempt to force Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad to testify in the sodomy case as his appeal reached Malaysia's highest court, the federal court. Anwar believes that Mahathir's testimony could support his claim that all the charges against him are fabrications by a top-level political conspiracy. But when Chief Justice Yusuf Chin refused to disqualify himself from the case at Anwar's request, Anwar dropped his appeal, charging the judge was subservient to and beholden to Mahathir. Anwar was abruptly fired from his cabinet posts and leadership role in the ruling UMNO party in September 1998. After his calls for reform of corruption and cronyism in Mahathir's government drew unprecedented crowds to rallies, he was arrested under an internal security law later that month and has been imprisoned ever since. Last year, he was sentenced to 6 years on charges relating to an alleged cover-up of sexual misconduct. If convicted on the sodomy charge, he could face another 20 years imprisonment.
New sentences were handed down in Australia for 2 men who killed a gay man in the mistaken belief that he had raped a woman. The Melbourne community was shocked when a trial court let Christian Dieber and John Whiteside walk free with suspended sentences after they pleaded guilty to manslaughter. Many felt that the life of openly gay Keith Hibbins was devalued by the sentence. This week, an appeals court unanimously agreed, laying 6-year prison terms on both men, of which they must serve at least 4 years. The court noted the viciousness of the assault on the much older Hibbins and said the killers decided to take the law into their own hands and became without proper justification the judges and punishers of the deceased.
In the U.S., a court's decision to try a 17-year-old suspect as an adult ended official secrecy in a West Virginia murder many believe was a hate crime. J.R. Warren, an African-American gay man with mental and physical disabilities, was severely beaten and then run over several times with a car to make his death appear to be an accident. It was only revealed this week that Warren was still alive and conscious when he was run over. The suspects are two white 17-year-olds, one now named as David Parker, and a 15-year-old accessory. All of them confessed to police. The judge's findings of fact in ordering Parker to be tried as an adult did not really speak to motive in the case, although before the beating there was an argument about $20 that had disappeared from Warren's wallet. But gay and African-American civil rights groups are convinced there was bias motivation and were able to win a preliminary investigation by federal authorities into the case. Neither West Virginia nor federal hate crimes laws cover homophobic bias, but both include racist crimes. Activists have used the case in calling on the House of Representatives to vote on the Hate Crimes Prevention Act, which would add anti-gay attacks to federal law and greatly expand federal authorities' ability to investigate and prosecute suspected hate crimes.
A federal judge in Brazil has struck down HIV discrimination in the military. The judge struck down a 1997 executive decree that required periodic medical examinations and treatment for HIV-positive service members and forced their transfer to reserve status after 3 years, even if they were otherwise healthy. The case was filed by the Brazilian Attorney General's Office's District Attorney for Civil Rights. The DA had also hoped to stop mandatory HIV testing of those seeking to enlist, but the court upheld it.
Back in the U.S., a federal appeals court ended a potential threat to all the nation's civil rights laws protecting gays and lesbians. The full bench of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed a lawsuit by two Anchorage, Alaska landlords who claimed their Christian beliefs prevented their compliance with city and state civil rights laws that required them to rent to unmarried couples. They said the laws would force them to facilitate sin. Remarkably, a 3-judge panel of the federal appeals court last year reached a split decision in favor of the landlords. That ruling was negated when the full court agreed to take up the case. This week, the full court threw out the lawsuit, calling it purely hypothetical and a case in search of a controversy, since no complaints had ever been made against the landlords. The Ninth Circuit's jurisdiction includes 9 Western states.
Last week's federal court ruling in Australia striking down the state of Victoria's ban on reproductive treatment for women who don't live with men became a major national controversy this week. Prime Minister John Howard announced that his government would introduce an amendment to the National Sex Discrimination Act to allow the states to institute such restrictions. The Australian Democratic, Labour, and Green parties were quick to announce their opposition, although there are divisions within the Labour Party on the subject, among both national and Victorian elected officials. The opposition parties should be able to block Howard's amendment in the National Senate, but there is and will continue to be fierce debate. There were also at least 3 demonstrations protesting Howard's proposal. In Sydney, as many as 40 students crashed Howard's electorate office, and one was arrested following altercations with a nearly equal number of police officers. In Melbourne, students demonstrated outside the offices of Victoria's Premier, Steve Brax, who supports the restrictions. In Brisbane, students occupied a government office, trapping a half dozen staff in with them behind their barricade. Police forcibly removed the demonstrators.
France's radical left party this week threw out a senator for making anti-gay remarks. Senator François Abadie of the Pyrenees region, a former minister for tourism and mayor of Lourdes, first wrote in a national magazine that homosexuals were abnormal, destroyers of society who cared nothing about the future and a continuing danger of pedophilia. When a liberal democratic member of parliament wrote to object, Abadie responded that he should bugger himself. Radical Left Party Chair Jean-Pierre Bailey said Abadie's homophobic views are diametrically opposed to all our values and that the party is thoroughly ashamed of such words. Gay and lesbian activists, including the group SOS Homophobia, called for Abadi to be prosecuted for incitement of hatred.
Homophobic rhetoric from Britain's Conservative Party in its battle to retain the No Promo Homo Law, Section 28, finally became too much for the party's gay poster boy, colorful millionaire Ivan Massow. He defected to the Labour Party, saying he should have done so when now Prime Minister Tony Blair became leader in 1994. He said the party he's cherished since he was 14 years old now cannot be trusted to govern Britain, and that, under William Hague, the sad truth is that the Tories have become less compassionate, more intolerant, and frankly just plain nasty. Opinions differ as to just how significant Massow's exit is. Some say an attempt was made to bribe him into staying with the offer of a peerage. Others say his defection means nothing, and there's conflicting information as to whether the Conservatives had planned to run him for office next year.
An estimated 3,000 Japanese gays and lesbians turned out for a first gay day at Tokyo Disneyland. Like their counterparts in the U.S., it was not an official park event, but many of the gays and lesbians wore red T-shirts reading July Pride 2000 for visibility.
And finally, Texas political humorist Molly Ivins remarked on Republican presidential candidate and Texas Governor George W. Bush's hometown of Midland, a town she says is populated by rich, white-collar Republicans. Once she asked an American Civil Liberties Union board member from Midland if there had been any problems with gay bashing there. The answer was, "Oh, hell, honey, there's not a gay in Midland who will come out of the closet for fear people will think they're Democrats."
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 5th, 2000. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chase Schulte.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
As the Republican Party held its national convention the week of July 31st, there was frequently more of substance going on outside of Philadelphia's First Union Center than inside. Still, gay and lesbian Republicans had a more powerful presence than ever before, and left believing their acceptance proved that the party's policies could change. We'll hear more about the alternative actions around the convention from veteran activist Urvashi Vaid after an on-scene report from inside the convention and some analysis by This Way Out's Matt Alsdorf.
George W. Bush's rousing acceptance speech here in Philadelphia on Thursday night concluded one of the most tightly organized, carefully planned political conventions in history. Behind all this orchestrating was Governor Bush's campaign, which succeeded in presenting a new face to the country, one that was designed to appear more unified, compassionate, and accepting than the Republican Party ever has before. During the four evenings of speeches and entertainment, there was not a single direct mention of gay and lesbian people. However, the 19 gay delegates and alternates left convinced that their party had come to accept them. In fact, the day after the official convention concluded, the Log Cabin Republicans, the nation's largest gay GOP group, voted overwhelmingly to endorse Governor Bush, a move they attributed largely to their experiences at the convention. Among the highlights they cited was the Tuesday night speech of openly gay Arizona Congressman Jim Colby. Colby spoke for roughly 3 minutes on international trade issues and never brought up his sexuality. But this talk was deemed significant since it was the first time an openly gay Republican official had ever addressed a convention. A dozen members of the Texas delegation put their cowboy hats over their faces and bowed their heads in prayer as Colby spoke. They had threatened to walk out in protest, but the Bush campaign reportedly barred them from doing so, fearing it would reflect poorly on the party. Mary Cheney, the lesbian daughter of vice presidential nominee Dick Cheney, was also in attendance on the last two nights of the convention. The 31-year-old, who until recently worked on gay and lesbian outreach at Coors Corporation, apparently did not bring along the partner with whom she lives near Denver. But Mary Cheney did appear on stage with the Bush and Cheney clans, as well as high-ranking Republicans, for the celebration following Bush's speech. The Bush campaign has stated that the governor embraces Mary Cheney, and some anticipate that she will actively campaign for her father, but a role for her has not yet been specified. Delegates also said they felt more welcomed in their party in less official ways. First of all, there were simply more of them. At the 1996 convention, there were only 6 openly gay delegates and alternates, and in 1992, there were just 2. And for the first time, the 2 gay-oriented receptions appeared on some versions of the official schedule. Many gay delegates also said their delegations were welcoming to Log Cabin members. So the overall mood of the gay Republicans was quite upbeat, particularly as they compared the tone of this convention to previous ones. The most notable example, of course, being the 1992 convention in Houston, where the religious right had a prominent role, and Pat Buchanan gave his notorious speech declaring a culture war. That sort of rhetoric was entirely absent this time around. But looking beyond the rhetoric and the increased access gay Republicans say they have to the GOP powers that be, there were few gains to be celebrated. On the first day of the convention, the delegates ratified a party platform that included many anti-gay planks. Among them, opposition to gay civil rights and same-sex unions, as well as support for a return to the all-out ban on gays in the military and a recent Supreme Court decision barring gays from the Boy Scouts. Although Bush had supported the removal of these planks from an earlier draft of the platform, his stated policy positions remain aligned with the right wing of the GOP. Despite his meeting with 12 gay Republicans in April, after which he called himself a better man and promised that he would judge people based only on their hearts, Bush has never officially renounced his across-the-board opposition to gay rights, nor his support for the Texas statute outlawing sodomy. For those reasons, a number of nonpartisan and democratic gay organizations remain highly skeptical of the supposed new Republican tolerance for gays and lesbians. Among them is the nation's largest gay rights group, the Human Rights Campaign. At the end of the week, they released two statements. One of them called attention to what they called the hypocrisy of the GOP's talk of inclusion but continued opposition to gay rights. And in another, they questioned the LCR's endorsement of Bush, saying, quote, "For gay and lesbian Americans, there is no clear rationale or coherent reason to support Bush's candidacy," end quote. So while those gay GOP members who were here in Philadelphia left relatively satisfied with how things had gone, it appears that they have an uphill battle to convince other GLBT people that the Republican reforms went far enough to warrant them. Reporting for This Way Out from the National Republican Convention in Philadelphia, I'm Matt Alsor.
What role, if any, or what impact, if any, do you think Mary Cheney is going to have?
That's the million-dollar question in a lot of ways. There's a couple ways it could play out. I think the most hopeful way is that that Mary Cheney becomes a part of the campaign, and that really highlights the contradiction between compassionate rhetoric and saying, I embrace my gay daughter, or I embrace my running mate's gay daughter, yet I don't think she should be able to adopt, nor marry her partner, nor be protected from gender discrimination, etc. And that would force them and push them to change their stances on those issues. And that's certainly a possibility that it would move in that direction, but I think it's overly optimistic to think that it's going to have a major impact on the policy stances. I think the more likely scenario is that it will act as kind of a shield for the Bush-Cheney ticket against charges of intolerance. They'll be able to point to Mary Cheney and say, look, here's this person who we both embrace and love dearly and think is a wonderful person. We're not intolerant.
Did she give any interviews to gay or press in general, or was she completely silent?
My belief is that she was entirely silent. I don't know of anyone who was able to get to Mary Cheney.
What sense did you get? I assume you were on the convention floor.
Yeah.
What sense did you get about how truly accepting the rank and file that were on the convention floor are of gays and lesbians?
I spent a lot of time interviewing delegates and alternates, particularly on Thursday night, which was the final night of the convention. And I interviewed them about a lot of issues and did not identify myself as a member of the gay press. So they were not aware that they needed to filter their views in order to speak to me. However, they were all quite reluctant to be overtly homophobic. They continually sounded the note of tolerance and said, well, you know, what you do or what someone does is their business. It's not mine. We embrace all people in the Republican Party. However, once you got past that sort of rhetoric and you pushed them on any particular issue, whether it be marriage or adoption or hate crimes or employment non-discrimination or what have you, they usually oppose those almost across the board. So there seemed to be a certain contradiction between the rhetoric of acceptance and embracing gay people and, you know, a real commitment to making sure that equality is achieved. The delegates are very, very excited about George W. Bush, not necessarily because of his policies, although that's part of it, but it's largely because they just want a Republican back in the White House and they think that George W. Bush can win. And so a lot of people, I think, are willing to overlook at this point pretty substantial differences between themselves and George W. Bush, or between themselves and other people in the party, just in order to get him elected.
Would you think that is, at least in part, what motivated Lord Cabiners to endorse him?
Yeah, I think that certainly is part of it, and the Log Cabin Republicans are very explicit about their strategy, which is to make sure that gay rights becomes a bipartisan issue, and that both of the parties have to compete for the gay vote instead of the Democrats being able to essentially take it for granted, which for the most part they have been in past elections. So I think that wanting a Republican in the White House, or at least wanting a Republican to be competitive on the gay vote, is part of what motivates them. The other thing is that I think that the people who have met with George W. Bush and are close to people who have met with George W. Bush have a very different sense of where he is in terms of his personal attitude towards gays, and possibly in terms of his anticipated policy about gay and lesbian issues, than those of us who haven't been privy to those meetings. There's no one has said it explicitly, but there's a lot of sort of vague discussion about how much progress has been made in the meeting, and references to signals that the Bush campaign has sent that they're going to make some substantive policy changes in the near future. And no one will really sit down and say that in one sentence and explicitly say, here are the areas where we've made progress, here is what we expect in terms of substantive issue changes from the Bush campaign, but there's a lot of talk about how that's in the works. So that I think, is the other thing that motivates a lot of Kevin Republicans. They think that some of these substantive issues will change and change soon.
That was reporter Matt Alsdorf at the Republican National Convention in conversation with This Way Out's Greg Gordon.
I just finished organizing and curating an art exhibit that's going to tour around the country, and it's called Norman Rockwell, The Lesbian Years. The art world is abuzz. It is 30 heretofore undiscovered pictures by Norman Rockwell of two lesbians who live down the road from him, Bea and Thelma. And they're beautiful pictures. They're done in the classic Norman Rockwell style. One of my favorites is a pen and ink of a lesbian potluck. A Thanksgiving potluck, heads bent in thanks over steaming bowls of miso. It's beautiful. And then there's another one, a shaving scene. I don't understand it. And there's another one called Ecstasy One, and it's of Bea and Thelma, and the detailing on the leatherwork is really intense.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton, global lesbian. Listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Partisan politics is just one approach to achieving social change, according to Urvashi Vaid of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute. Vaid was in Philadelphia along with a broad range of activists who gathered at Unity 2000 to discuss the key issues being ignored at the Republican convention.
I'm here because this party continues to not speak to the issues that I care about, and I'm here to register my voice in protest to many of the policies and positions that it stands for, and I'm here to agitate and build a movement for social change in this country.
What is it about this party that doesn't represent a group you're representing, or why is this party not representing?
I think this party is a party of corporate elites, and it is a party that is hostile to civil rights. It's a party that long ago abdicated its concern for the ordinary person. And yet, it's a party with brilliant PR, endless amounts of money for marketing, and great writers. They have wonderful, wonderful speech writers, much better than the Democrats or Ralph Nader ever has. But in all seriousness, I think the problems that I see in the country are problems of racial inequality, homophobia, gender inequality, economic injustice. I see problems of working class people not being able to make ends meet, of people without health insurance, of young people who are getting substandard education when we could be providing first class education, and on and on and on. And those are the issues that many of us feel are pressing in this country, and this party doesn't speak to them, or if it does address those issues, and when it does address those issues, it addresses them in ways that serve a narrow elite spectrum. So its answer to poverty is to privatize welfare and to give the contracts to the defense contractors. Its answer to education is to provide vouchers so people can send their kids to private schools and to subsidize religious schools. It has no answer to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. I think the importance of the Unity Rally is it is an effort to try to build something that doesn't exist, that exists only in our imagination, which is a new politics and a new movement that brings together people who share values, values of social justice. And it's not a perfect process to bring together very individualistic and independent and ideologically different strands of the center to the left spectrum, which is what the spectrum that Unity was trying to present. I emceed 1 hour of the rally this afternoon, and it was a real eclectic mix of issues. The thing is, and I've been to many of these rallies as a speaker, speaking on gay and lesbian issues, and this is one of the first I've been as part of the MC team. And what's always interesting is you bring all these people up on stage who have no relationship to each other outside the stage. We meet backstage, we talk to each other for 10, 15 minutes, or we hang out for a couple of hours while we're waiting, and you make some connections. But then everybody goes back into their separate units, the environmental movement, the racial justice movement, the gay and lesbian, bi, trans movement. We all work pretty much in individual silos. And the challenge is not just to hold a unity rally, but to create a unified progressive movement that respects the variety of issues that people carry. And nobody's really found that hinge, that bridge, that key. I think the key will come in an articulation of shared values. I'm very driven by values in my organizing work. This movement has grown dramatically in the last 4 years, in the last 5 years. And it's because of the new student movement that is emerging around sweatshops and labor issues. It's because the environmental movement has suddenly grown. Not suddenly, but it has grown. I mean, because the environmental realities are so pressing. And it's because the so-called identity-based movements of which I work in, the gay and lesbian movement, groups like the Black Radical Congress and progressives inside each of the identity movements have been organizing really actively and saying the same message. In the GLBT community, there are many of us who are progressive, and we say to our people, we need to see ourselves as part of a broader social justice movement.
That was Urvashi Vaid of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force Policy Institute discussing Unity 2000, an alternative gathering to the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia.
Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Chase Schulte, Chris Ambidge, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Rex Walkner, and Matt Alsdorf contributed program material. Thanks also to the Independent Media Center of Philadelphia. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music.
Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from the Gill Foundation, the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, and by Planet Out. From designated contributions from Uncommon Cloud Visa card holders who've chosen This Way Out, and through charitable donations from our listeners around the world.
For audio cassette information or with any questions or comments about This Way Out, please email us at tworadio@aol.com, visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And please be sure to include the call letters of this station.
Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on multimedia, then on radio.
This Way Out is produced by Lucia Chappell
and Greg Gordon, and we thank you for listening on KZSC Santa Cruz, California,
Planet FM Auckland, New Zealand,
KAOS Olympia, Washington,
and more than 100 other stations around the world,
including this community radio station.
Do stay tuned.